Hey, everybody, and welcome to a new episode of The Cusp Show, the Columbia University Sports Podcast, where I, Tom Richardson, talk the business of sports with my colleague and friend, Joe Favorito. Joe, welcome.
Hello, Tom. How are you?
Good. Good to be back getting into rhythm on these podcasts. I want to actually say I'm looking forward to having a conversation today that's not about COVID and not about lockdown and not about quarantining, but it's actually about some cool stuff as it relates to media and marketing in the business right now, especially in the realm of digital and social media, which is, of course, everybody knows our favorite topic to discuss. And it really centers on storytelling, which I guess is your probably number one mantra. If there was one hashtag I would give Joe Favorito, it would be hashtag storytelling. So everybody, we've got a great guest today. It's someone that Joe and I are just getting to meet for the first time, although admittedly we did speak before the podcast. And there's going to be a lot to talk about because she has a really cool background in the business and she's doing some amazing things right now that are right up our alley in this sports business, particularly as it relates to media and digital. So please welcome Raleigh Gray, who has this incredible resume that includes some of the highest profile places in the business, such as University of Virginia, Vanderbilt, ESPN, Twitter, Players Tribune, and most recently, Wasserman. So Raleigh, welcome.
Thank you, guys. You can be my lead-in and hype folks anytime. That's really, okay. I appreciate
it. Yeah, we have a side hustle as publicists for our podcast guests.
I actually have a full-time job doing that.
So. Okay, great.
Yeah, tell us what you do. We'll allow you to promote at the end of the show. So just
wonderful.
But you have to answer some questions first. So, Raleigh, as we told you, we like to give our guests a chance to kind of tell their story for the edification of our audience. Your story is particularly interesting and probably will be quite inspiring to especially our students in this program. So why don't we start with that? Just rewind the tape a little bit. Give us a sense of how you got to where you are right now, having had all these interesting experiences over the last 8 or 10 years.
Sure. Well, Tom and Joe, thanks again for having me and to all the students listening for lending your ear for this time. I sincerely appreciate it. But my story is one that I will say basically can be categorized as if at first you don't succeed, try, keep trying again. I was the kid who, and I'm sure you guys did this, but you got to put together a time capsule when you were in like eighth grade. And I did that. I put together a time capsule and I said, I want to work at ESPN. And at that time, I thought it was just someone on TV, right? I didn't know anything about the business. I just thought television, sports, love those things. That's what I'm going to do. So when I got to UVA, I had played high school athletics. I got injured pretty badly, so I wasn't able to play collegiate. And I found every opportunity to stay involved in sports, just because I knew that's what I wanted to do. So I worked in the sports information office. Thankfully, at that time, Virginia was opening a brand new arena. So a lot of pomp and circumstance, really good excuse to get to know a lot of people. And I was working at the ACC tournament that year, because Virginia is part of the Atlantic Coast Conference. And I was running stats. And most students won't believe that you literally ran pieces of paper up arena steps or delivered them to Dick Vitale on the sideline, et cetera. And everyone asked to do the sideline delivery, obviously, because that's what got you on TV. But I wanted to go to the suites because I knew exactly where Johnny Swafford and all of the guys who went to Carolina who were working at ESPN were sitting. And that's who I wanted to see. So I was lucky enough to meet a lot of those people and get a summer internship at ESPN. I will caveat that with the, if at first you don't succeed, I do have a letter that says we cannot extend an internship to you this summer. And I pushed really hard knowing that before the ACC tournament to get in with them. So it's not always easy to get this resume stacked up. And that is bottom line for this whole conversation. But I managed to turn that into a full-time opportunity. Once I got there, I sort of looked around and thought, this is amazing. But I said I wanted to do this when I was 12 and I'm 22. I gotta find another dream. So I had some amazing times and learnings at ESPN. but I pivoted quickly and went back to business school because that was going to teach me a lot of things outside of what I already had kind of experienced working in marketing and affiliate sales and those things. Went to business school, great experience. Yeah.
Hey, Ryan, I'm sorry to interrupt, but I'm curious. Did you actually move up to Bristol or were you working in New York City?
It's a great question. I was lucky enough, and I say lucky enough because I grew up in Nashville, Tennessee, and I went to Charlottesville for college to be in New York. And I learned as much from the city of New York as I did from my role. So
West 66th Street?
Exactly. West 66, 605 3rd Avenue, and then 34th Street were all my offices at one time or another. And you guys may not remember this. If you do, thank you. But ESPN invested in their own MVNO, meaning their own cell phone. And that was the first business I worked on.
One of the great failures of all time.
By the way, it was a billion-dollar plus disaster for the company.
One of
the biggest fails in the history of tech, I might add. We won't talk about that.
No, but you know what? It's great to actually cover it because you think of them at that time as being this behemoth that was just firing all cylinders and everything they did turned to gold. But the best thing they did with that was admit they were wrong. And immediately the iPhone came out when I was working for them. So they were a step ahead to create an app. And that's where I got to be on the new media side of things early.
Okay, cool.
Yeah, it was great. So business school was definitely the right decision because I got to learn things that I hadn't experienced from a finance and accounting side, operations, just traditional business structures. And I really wanted to put that in practice. So I shipped myself out to San Francisco, having done a finance role for my summer internship in between business school. I was couch surfing. I did not have a job. I know I disappointed the Vanderbilt career management folks when I turned down my offer at Credit Suisse to continue in their program full time. And I said, I want to work in tech and here's how I'm going to plan my days. And it had come up to about 6 weeks without any bites. I was going to move home and figure something out. And I get a call from Twitter, thanks to a lot of connections, mainly with UVA. And I botched that first interview in a big way. It was a gentleman from Google who gave me a case study. I wasn't prepared for it. How many basketballs are there in the US? Completely modeled them poorly. I didn't do it off households.
What?
I did it off people. I know. Those Google people.
Was that given to you in advance or was that a live question?
It was not. It was a live question over the phone while the
I would have just gotten up and left the
stop. I mean, that's come on.
So the best part of that story though is the gentleman who hit me with that question, and admittedly I got off the phone, full tears, started packing my apartment, but emailed and said, can we please try this again? And he accepted, became my boss. And I have an email from him saying, with some expletives in a good way, I was a real idiot. I'm so glad we took you on. So
he's now one
of my closest friends.
He's
a gentleman named Dan Green. He now works at Impossible Meats and does a lot of their sales side of stuff. He's pivoted from Google to Twitter to other stuff and now there to kind of run that business as a tech business. And I don't think he'll care that I mention it because he's awesome.
Mm-hmm. Nice. So before we let you go on to Twitter and talk about Twitter, did you at UVA, did you cross paths with the legendary Rich Murray at all?
I worked for Rich when
Rich
I was
Murray
in
is
SAD.
A legend,
yeah.
Absolute legend.
So, I'm so happy to hear that as well. I always thought the same.
So
what was
one quick story.
SID, Joe?
Yeah, so legendary. But one very funny story was 100 years ago when I was in the SID business, and it was almost 100 years ago. Every year at the COSIDA convention, they used to do this thing called the Hoostag, which was put together by Rich Murray and a friend of mine named Jay Williams, who was at Fairfield. And it would be kind of this rogues gallery of people drinking Genesee beer until 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning.
Genesee.
Yeah.
Nice.
With
upstate New York.
Yeah. And because one of the guys who led it was a guy named Wally Johnson, who was the SID for about 150 years at St. Lawrence University. So the Hoostag became this legendary thing that people did if you were like not willing to go and you know, worry about your schedule making that day at COSIDA. So, but Rich Murray, I was at the original Hoostag with Jay Williams and Rich Murray way before you were born, Raleigh. And, you know, those are the memories that you kind of get. But talk about someone learning from a legend. I mean, one of the great people, but also one of the more innovative people in a business, which sometimes on the sports information side becomes kind of like, you know, doing stats and that's all you did. So, but Virginia was never that way, which was great. So,
by the way, Raleigh, you said you had to run actual paper back and forth. Your job, Joe was running stone tablets.
Yes. As matter, we were building the stone tablets at the time. So
quite chiseled. Yeah. I know. I see.
So along those lines, one more thing before I forget. So Tom, I don't know, we've talked about Almost Famous before a couple times, and it's been on recently again.
Oh, great.
Great story, Cameron Crowe. Yeah. And in there's one of my favorite lines of all time when he calls the offices at Rolling Stone, and Ben Fong-Torres gets on the phone, and we want you to go to the Daily News and use this thing called a Mojo. It's state of the art. It prints a page every 18 minutes, and that's how we want you to send the story.
That's great. Joe, a quick trivia question on that movie. Who played the Rolling Stone boss? That guy you just referenced. Ooh, Raleigh, do you know?
The Rolling Stone boss? So the guy who
played... The guy the Rolling Stone, like... I want to say it's somebody famous, and I want to say Philip Seymour Hoffman.
Oh, Philip Seymour Hoffman played his boy, his like the small magazine that he came from.
Okay, whatever.
But the best. All right,
so we don't want to keep going on trivia about that movie. But you know who plays the manager who comes and gets them, right?
I don't remember.
Jimmy Fallon.
Really?
Wow. Yes, and Jimmy Fallon has one of the best lines ever when he's talking to him about taking them over. And, you know, he's talking about growing the band's footprint for years. And he stands up and he goes, "You don't think like Mick Jagger is going to be jumping around on the stage at 50, do you?" So
yeah, sounds like you spent some time watching and rewatching that movie, Joe. But anyway, let's get back to Raleigh.
Twitter.
Please, this is much better than me. Let's keep going.
Yeah. All right. So You tried to do an ESPN smartphone and you failed, and then you got
and failed. Yeah, I tried to get into Twitter, failed, but then succeeded. And I was lucky enough to be early at Twitter, where they had not established a sales strategy or anything to sell. So I got to help work with our product managers and product marketing to build, whether it was in-app purchases or things that sort of already existed at our competitors, and build the sales engine, move into supporting our athletes on the platform. And then at the very end of my tenure, I was supporting our then CFO, who became COO, Anthony Noto, who had been the prior CFO at the NFL. Yeah. He is amazing. I had the good fortune of working with him and propping up our live strategy. So you may recall that Twitter had 10 games that they were tri-casting on live on Twitter before Amazon bought the NFL rights, and getting that up and running from a product perspective, from a business perspective, was most of what I spent my last year there doing. And it was phenomenal, very cool. My husband hates this branding, but I say, unfortunately, I got married and had to move, and I then left Twitter because of that. He claims, you know, "Oh, you're in marketing. Shouldn't you rebrand that?" I'm like, "No, that's exactly what happened. I love Twitter, and you made me leave." So I moved to Charlotte, North Carolina, but the minute we got married, I relocated to New York, and we split time. So that's where I picked up on starting sort of my own consulting, and then took on Players Tribune.
Wow. Okay. So just go back to Twitter for a second. I'm curious, the time you were there, when you got into helping the athletes, who are the big great tweeters among big athletes at that point in history?
Honestly, at that time, so that was 2016, and the platform had an interesting problem, which has since been remedied because they have an amazing CEO or CMO. CAO, yes, but CMO Leslie Berlin, who came from Amex, who has really shifted the understanding of what Twitter is. But you guys may not have known, because you are so into the platform itself. When you go to Google and you type in, "I don't get," and you can get an immediate response. Right. If you typed in 2016, I don't get Twitter was the first thing that popped up.
Really?
And that was the problem. People didn't understand how to use it. So making sure that athletes felt supported. And at that time, it was anyone from, you know, a LeBron James to the newest draft pick whose profile was going to instantly change. That's who we were really working with.
So that time frame, was that pre-Vine, post-Vine, during Vine?
Mid-Vine, if you will. Yeah. So Vine joined us, I want to say, in 2015. I may be misquoting that, but it was certainly around that time. Mm-hmm. And Vine, as you guys are, again, well aware, really changed the way that pre-roll marketing works. So whatever you see in front of the content, 6 seconds became something normal. And that's what Vine was. It was a 6 second video medium that was supposed to tell a story very quickly. And luckily people got used to it.
Yeah, ahead of its time.
And then Snapchat stole it. Yeah. 6 seconds. Yeah.
I can neither confirm nor deny.
I mean, no one owns 6 seconds. So it's just funny how everybody settled on 6 seconds. There must have been some psychologists involved or something.
Exactly. Exactly.
Anyway, so continue. Post Twitter and post your consulting work, you ended up, and you did Players Tribune relatively briefly, it sounds like.
Yeah.
What did you learn in that job about the growing interest and activity among athletes, essentially becoming media channels and media brands?
Yeah, absolutely. The Players Tribune has such an interesting value proposition, and there are a couple reasons I went to go work for them. First and foremost, most of the team that had been accumulated, I actually worked with back at ESPN in 2006 and 7 and 605 with that phone, the ill-fated phone, and being around people that you really like to work with when there's a challenge is awesome. So I was working with them, also some former Twitter folks, tweeps as we call them, and understanding how athletes want to use their platform to tell their story and to, your point of Joe loving storytelling, to own that story. It was something that was really fascinating that Players Tribune was doing very well and still continues to do very well because they have the trust of that side. So it was really fascinating to not only see that, but put it into practice and then find ways to scale it, which is, of course, what they're continuing to work on today.
Hey, Raleigh, I want to ask you a specific question about Players Tribune that always that I've been thinking about for years, because every semester my digital class, my digital media class, one of the papers is about attacker brands, so newer brands that are attacking the status quo. And I would say every semester, at least a couple of people pick the Players Tribune, since it's still relatively new. What a lot of people notice, and this comes after we had studied digital media for the first month or so, is that, as you probably know, that platform does not allow user commentary on the stories. I say that is a huge fail. And I gotta believe it's a factor in them not having the success I think a lot of people thought they would have. You know, they were sold last year to Minute Media. And so I'm not disparaging it, because I do believe it's a good platform, but it seems like a fundamental premise of modern interactive communications was missed by not providing a forum for the readers to actually go a little bit deeper and engage more. Am I missing something, or is that a fair criticism?
I would say it's a fair criticism, but I don't know. And again, I wasn't in the first room with Derek and Jamie when they started the platform, but I do believe that what they were trying to cut through was a lot of that noise that oftentimes platforms that allow for the commentary, or perhaps former employers of mine that just air a story and have consistent commentary around it, to kind of eliminate that and just say, this is the story as it is. And if the athlete felt comfortable in posting it to their digital channel, that's where some of that exchange would happen. But I think what they were trying to achieve was really, let's just put it in black and white, much like their logo and their branding of, here's what it is. And you can push back on me, but you won't do it here. Those things sort of already existed. So yes, I agree with you that there's always the next step to take it to if you feel like you're going to have a conversation. And that's what a lot of their pieces are about. But I think they felt that that medium existed and they were creating a safer space for the athletes and continue to do
that's,
so.
That's a fair response. Yeah, I'm still not sure if it's, there might've been, I mean, we can get off this, but there might've been a way to do it that was a good compromise. It just feels like they probably gave up a lot of minutes of engagement, ultimately stuff that drives value in digital media, by essentially pushing any of that conversation to other environments, which they didn't really get value from, frankly. So anyway.
Sure.
Okay. So after PT, you moved on to
Wasserman.
Wasserman.
Yes. So I joined Wasserman a little over a year ago, my first foray into an agency. And it's been awesome. You know, we have two sides of our house. We have talent and then we have brands and properties. And learning how those two interact or learning directly on the talent side about agents and athletes and those relationships that I hadn't been privy to before has been awesome. But my current role, based on my background, is to help, along with the support of the rest of our team, a group called Athlete Exchange. And we just effectively help athletes with their digital channels and understanding the value of them and why they should invest in them, and then helping them to create that content.
So let's talk about Athlete Exchange. Two questions. One is, you look at things like Influencer or Open Doors, which have built a business on literally on the backs of thousands of athletes, bringing them opportunities for brands to engage in the social space. How is it different? And then how, if I'm looking at this and I'm an agent at Athletes First, CAA, IMG, why would I let my athlete go and do something with Wasserman when they have representation? Two questions.
Yeah, absolutely. So to your first question about the existing platforms, be it Influencer or Open Doors or Greenfly, those are actually folks that we are really working with to some extent, because a lot of our athletes are already on those platforms, whether it's through league partnerships or if they were at a university that utilizes Influencer. So those are things that, because it helps their digital footprint to have access to that content, we love those guys. And it's different because what we're trying to do in two different sides, there's certainly the business side and the organic side. The organic side is what I spend most of my days focusing on, but obviously building the business is important as well. The way we're different from them is that everything we generate is typically through a conversation with the athlete to tell their story off the court, ice, or field. And they're sharing with us things that matter to them, that's important, and then it comes directly from their channel. So it's not the pre-programmed things that these awesome platforms allow the delivery of. Open Doors, Greenfly, et cetera, allow the seamless nature of posting those things. We actually get to the root to help with them for what they're going to post. And on the other side, on the competitive side, we obviously want to be able to service athletes to help them get additional revenue opportunities. And that's where we're working hand in hand with other agencies, because they certainly want to and have the goal of getting their athletes compensated for deals. And if we can bring them to them in a way that's helpful, we're happy to.
And can you give us a couple of examples that you really take pride in so far?
Yeah, I'll have to think about that. We've had quite a few to date, which is great. But typically where we're seeing the most success is when there's a brand that is not a title sponsor. So let's say it's the playoffs for a league and this particular bank doesn't have the access to using words like playoff or whatever the league or teams, et cetera, are. But they want to play in the space, to your point of sort of the attacker brand earlier. Mm-hmm. They would pay us to put together a campaign and have in some instances, and I can share that with you guys as a follow-up more directly, and not be as vague about what I'm talking about, but they engage with the athletes to then put together that program. And that way they're still relevant during a time when people aren't paying attention to them. And because they're trying to use athletes that are around that game, not participating, they go to different agencies to get the right people to tell that story. So that one's been really great. And then certainly our athletes all have individual things that they work on, whether it's a retail sponsor like Adidas or Nike apparel, obviously, et cetera, or individual ones that are more localized. And we just help them satisfy those things so that it's easy and turnkey. And particularly if it's the middle of their season, many of which, as I know, haven't been right now, but if it's the middle of their season, then we can help them satisfy those things in a way that doesn't take away from the game they play.
So following up on that, and I'll only use the word ambush once.
Okay.
How does Wasserman, as a company that does big events as well, avoid conflicts where you have a sponsor that you've sold in for a title sponsor, yet someone may come to you and say, this is, you know, Outback Steakhouse Bowl, you know, can you go get us something with, you know, another state company? How do you overcome that? Or how do you say we can't do that because of that?
Yeah, it's a great question. And typically, we've been pretty agnostic just because of where we sit. We are our own company within the company. So that helps us kind of put up some guardrails in that we are tunnel vision on our goal and role, and we can keep out the noise and obviously the competitive things that are necessary from the brands and properties that are on the other side that we won't always communicate with where we need to not to.
Okay. Raleigh, based on your experience with athletes at Twitter, PT, and Athlete Exchange, let me ask you this question. Are good new age media personalities born, or are they made?
Very Gary V-ish with that question.
Tom.
Well, it just feels like sometimes, this is your answer, but I'll just add a quick perspective, that there's this notion in digital media, like everybody needs to be a creator. Everybody's got to put stuff out there. Everybody's got to tell their story. But let's admit it, guys, not everybody's good at or wants to be telling their story 24/7. Now, plenty of people love to do that, but it is a little bit of a talent, I would say, in terms of the way you ideate and things like that and how creative you are. And whether it's in our personal lives with friends and family or even professionally, some people just have no interest in doing it. Some people just are really gifted at doing it. And I doubt they went to school for it, if you know what I mean. So I'm curious about what you think about that question and whether you provide any training. Like, can you turn a bad media person into a good media person?
Born or made, turn them good or bad. It's interesting. I hadn't thought of it that way. So if I stutter a bit, please forgive me.
But I'm just trying to stump you with some new questions.
Yeah, well, you're going to, clearly. But I would say that it's a hybrid, and that's a cop-out, but I'll get there and you'll see why. I think you're born with the innate personality that has to come through a device, right? It's not something that a lot of people can do and do well, but if you can, then you're able to make yourself into something different. We can always train people about how to use platforms, and there's a ton of data that derives into a best practice or something along those lines. You can be an expert as long as you stay up on Instagram, TikTok, Twitter, Facebook, Snapchat. You can figure out that, YouTube certainly as well, but you have to still have that personality to actually make it happen. And you have to have the interest, because quite frankly, it's a lot of work. Yeah. So if you don't have the interest,
and it never stops. Right.
Exactly. Yeah. And if you have to be reactionary, et cetera, it's something that you really have to have an interest in. And we work with our athletes based on signals that they give us to say they're interested. We're never going to force them to do this if it is just not their bag. And that's fine. We just want to share the value, share our knowledge, and share that it's up to them.
Quick follow-up. I know Joe has a question, but I want to do a quick follow-up. One of your athletes is Alex Morgan, correct?
Yes.
Right. So she's probably, if not the most famous female athlete in America, a top three. Is that fair to say?
She's got some teammates that we represent as well with.
Yeah, Mayor, I mean, Pino, again, so right, yes. That crowd of like super successful, you know, women's national team players. So yeah, we know who they are. And they are the biggest female sports inspirations probably in the business right now, which is great. Because they're so famous in social media, what part of the agenda of their, when they're in creator mode and media personality mode, can be proactive versus reactive? So if something goes out on social media tonight about Alex Morgan, whether it's fair or not, or whether it's important or trivial, doesn't really matter. Suddenly Alex Morgan is all over Twitter and Instagram or something like that. Do you advise these players to jump into the fray and deal with some of the reactive elements of this? Or are you telling them to stick to their knitting and be more proactive as much as they can be in terms of driving their own narrative?
We typically lean on the side of, if it is something that they would like to engage in, because that is part of who they are, go for it. And certainly agents and others that surround them will chime in on some thoughts or scenario planning, just so they can play a little devil's advocate to let them know the various outcomes. But at the end of the day, if we put them in too much of a box, obviously that's not the way that people are. We're multidimensional. You have tons of things that drive you to be successful. It's just that they're known, these athletes, typically for one thing. So I'm advising them at all times to stay true to who they are. And if they get into a conversation and they need some help getting out of those weeds, happy to advise, but really want them to be unique and them and authentic to that.
Do you explicitly advise them to stay out of politics?
No.
Okay, so if they choose to weigh in on current events, political situations, issues, it's cool.
Absolutely.
I mean, you run the risk, of alienating a certain percentage of the audience, obviously, but that's up to them.
Absolutely. Again, okay. The part of the multidimensional nature of who they are,
right.
If it's showcasing them and they understand the elements you just talked about, by all means, yeah. Be you.
And in your personal opinion, how engaged in sensitive political and social matters should good athlete creators be? I mean, you see, like, LeBron was in the news this week because of, you know, the tragedy in Georgia. Should they lean in on that stuff, do you think? Or does it go back to it depends like on the personality? And Joe, I'd like to get your opinion too, since you advise these folks and these companies as well.
I think it's up to the athlete. I mean, one of the things that people have always misunderstood about quote media training is that you can only lead a horse so far before they have to decide whether they want to drink it or not. And as long as you're advising them, that's up to whoever the person is, whether you're an athlete or, you know, somebody just happens to be on Twitter. I think that's the most you can do. As long as they understand what the consequences are of what they say, that's part of being an adult or sometimes an underage athlete who happens to have a good form. So that's my opinion anyway.
Raleigh?
Yeah, you know, the old mantra we had at Twitter was think before you tweet. And just like anything, your footprint will be out there. So if you are going to get behind something, you know, to Joe's point, just understand that words have power and therefore oftentimes action. And as long as you're prepared for that, and as long as you feel comfortable sharing who you are with the masses, by all means. Mm-hmm. We certainly never want to put a muzzle on somebody to say, don't be you, because doing that would then inevitably have them trip over themselves at some point, because perfection is definitely not in anyone who is a human mentality, right? There's always going to be something that you need to share. And if you're being muzzled, it's not something that's going to be an option for you.
Raleigh, here's another heavy question. As different media outlets figure out what to do in terms of athlete-driven media, as we call it in my class, is it a zero-sum game? Can Players Tribune, now under the auspices of Minute Media, lead against Uninterrupted, which is LeBron James, Maverick Carter, versus the direct to consumer, let's call it, of the accounts of individual athletes that are really famous, Ronaldo, LeBron James, etc., versus the attempts by different properties like ESPN to continue to engage athletes for media creation purposes. Like, how much can the market sustain? Like, and how do you think it'll play out over the next few years?
You know, I have this conversation a lot, and so it is a heavy question. There's no real right answer, but I think what you've seen over time, because I don't know about you guys, but I used to get Sports Illustrated, and I would open straight to the back page with Rick Riley, and that was the first thing I read,
yeah,
right? And I was actively...
And Steve Rushen, too. He was really good.
Yeah, you just actively chose exactly what you had that magazine for, and then you went through the rest, and that was your content pack there. Content, since then, has expanded, and now it's going to contract, I think, in such a way that, much like the Facebook shift to community and their algorithm, everyone has their niche and need for this type of content. So you go to Players Tribune to hear some depth of story. You go to Uninterrupted to hear depth of diversity, different types. There's a reason for everything, including the social platforms that come out. So as long as each of these are playing to their culture and their purpose and their community, I think you'll continue to see that athlete-driven media play out just in the different roles that it plays for those organizations. Mm-hmm. And that's sort of how I think of it, but there's so much content out there, you do have to pick your noise.
Right.
So two things on that. One is there was a time when athletes, male or female, would come along and their agent would have them go, or they'd be interested in buying a restaurant or a club or whatever it was they were investing in. Then suddenly they all became tech, you know, whizzes, and they all knew everything about the tech space, which I've worked with a lot of athletes and some of them don't know a lot about the tech space, but they thought they were going to be. Then something you just touched on, everybody wants to be a content creator now. And there are endless number of athletes who have now created their own quote content businesses, not with a lot of content coming out of the other side, because it's hard to do, as you said. So you just said something about a contraction. Why do you believe that? And then the other piece of that would be, because I haven't heard anybody say that really. Then the other side of that would be authenticity, which you also touched on, and how much of it is the actual athlete, him or her, or him or her's quote team handing it off, where they're, you know, I've seen the famous pictures or been around them where you're handing your phone off to somebody else to tweet for you. So is it really them, and how important is them? And then why do you think there's going to be a contraction?
So to the first point of them, I used to love, and certainly don't want to necessarily bring politics into it, but from a best practice perspective, when Barack Obama was in the White House, you knew which tweets were his because mm-hmm. they would illustrate that for you. And I love the idea of that, because we're all too aware when you see an athlete on the court, field, ice, et cetera, and then you see a tweet come out from, you knew they didn't have their phone in their hand. You're watching it at that time. Yeah, exactly. I'm so confused, right? We know it wasn't you. It was a handler, somebody around you. So I like being able to denote, and people are smart enough. So let's not play into the thinking that they're idiots for that point, and give them that ownership. So I like being able to cut through that and share. I think that's something that's really important so that you're not misled. On the other side of the athlete content business, and keep me honest to the exact question, I see it as more, going back to your other side of it, ownership of whatever they're putting out into the space. Because like we talked about a minute ago with athlete-driven media, if you put out an Instagram video, it used to be that they would just sort of throw it up there without any attribution. And now they're saying this came from the at handle of that athlete. And that's where these content businesses really allow for athletes to own themselves and own whatever they're putting together. So I'm interested to see how they play out. I think certain athletes can have them and support them based on their status and standing and trajectory over time. And we'll see what that looks like. But I don't look at it so much as constantly creating their own content so much as owning what they're already putting out there. So it still can contract it a little bit.
Got it.
All right, I got one last question before we start getting into the final segment. What percentage, Raleigh, in your opinion, of professional athletes are making some money through influence marketing, influencer marketing?
If they have great representation, hopefully
100%. Oh, good answer. Snap. If they work with Wasserman and Athlete Exchange, they're just making money hand over fist.
You said it, Tom, not me.
Okay. No, but seriously, because it's, I mean, you think about an NFL team and you've got maybe 4 or 5 skill position players, or you add some defensive players, maybe 7 or 8 players that have an appreciable profile in our culture. And you've got like a lot of guys that just are literally not known by any big audiences. So are we looking at it? I imagine the answer would vary by sport. Like in a sport like basketball, it's got to be a higher percentage, less players, and there's a lot of famous guys in the starting fives. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I literally, as you were talking, thought about the nuances to it, and it is by sport, because if you think about the profiles, and again, my opinion, but I'm sure they're shared having talked to a lot of folks, if you think about the profile of an NBA athlete, They don't have a helmet like an NFL athlete. Right. So you can see them and you assimilate with them more. Whether you're an NHL athlete, and there was an advertisement this year, I was watching more Canadian threads on NHL TV, but it was all about we. And that's the way the game is in hockey. Yeah. They're very much a we sport.
Culturally.
So they don't necessarily want to step out of that to have some big social media presence alone. And then you think of the MLB, those guys get paid to play a lot of money. And therefore, they may just not take the time during season because they're recovering or doing something else post-game. That social stuff just doesn't matter to them. So there are nuances by sport, and there's certainly scale based on, you know, whether you're recognized or not, whether you're Russell Wilson versus the, you know, 39th man on the Hawks. But it's interesting. It's definitely something that will grow over time, particularly coming out of a time when sports haven't been active in the games, where people have really only had their social platforms as their voice.
Yeah, and social engagement has been good during this lockdown. It's been interesting to watch. Joe, did you have a final thought on the conversation?
Before we get to the last two, the steps you've taken, University of Virginia, ESPN, Twitter, Players Tribune, can you think of a couple people or instances that really influence you going forward? You mentioned Anthony Noto, some other people. We talked a little bit about Rich Murray. Are there a couple of people that really gave you the right advice at that time? And what did you learn from them along the way?
Sure. Wow. I mean, I've been lucky enough to have had some amazing mentors across my entire career, whether I knew they were mentors or not, whether it was like my high school soccer coach who would say stuff like, if you fail to prepare, you prepare to fail. And now I think about that all the time. And that was a long time ago. So whether it was Tim Wallace in high school soccer at Harpeth Hall, where I grew up in Nashville, Tennessee, or whether it was the dean of students at UVA who really pushed me when I knew I couldn't do athletics to say, hey, there's a whole world here at UVA. Why don't you explore? So I was also with Rich Murray, who you already mentioned, but I was thinking about student self-governance, this big thing we have at Virginia, and Barry Parkhill, who was an athlete there, who now I refer to as 2D. He's my second dad, and really takes care of me from the business perspective. To ESPN, when I was an intern, and I actually talked to this gentleman this morning, Matt Kenny. He still works at ESPN and has shifted different roles, but he, when I was an intern, let me speak to every C-suite in the office. I sat in George Bodenheimer's office. I was with Russell Wolf, who was the head of international at the time, Ed Durso. I sat with the CEO, Chris Andreessen, and I was an intern, but he gave me that to say, you can do this, go learn. Dustin Connolly and his wife were major influences at ESPN for me because they picked me up as an undrafted free agent out of college, and I got to have a full-time role. And at Twitter, I already mentioned Dan Green and bosses like Liat Bissell, and then certainly Anthony Noto, who has some military pedigree in him. He also was raised in a strong Italian family. Yeah, he's a West Point grad, and his mom sounds like she was a remarkable woman, but she definitely instilled in him a will to work hard and learn. And then other female mentors, Melissa Brenner at the NBA, could not be my bigger champion. I don't know how I got to know her and Matt. I think I ran into her on spring break with her kids and sent some cocktails over on behalf of Twitter, and all of a sudden we were good friends. So, I think
that's a good story.
Yeah, you know, the point is just make friends and then hopefully they'll want to take care of you. But yeah, those are a lot of names, but it's been a whole village that's made it possible for me.
Wow. So that's terrific, Brawley. Just thank you. That's really good stuff. And it's a good segue into our final couple of questions. And I'm going to reverse them. We usually ask about your knowledge acquisition first, but you just had a great line, like just make friends. You know, for someone who's been as fortunate as you with the experience you've had, you've got an amazing network. So that's awesome. And it sounds like you very early on realized the importance of a strong network. But can you offer any other specific career advice, particularly to the young people listening?
Sure. I've got two pieces. One, Anthony Noto gave me, and it's make your footprint bigger than your foot, obviously, meaning you know exactly. It's awesome, right? It just, it lingers. It's great. You do. But it's
just wear larger shoes.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
You know, you have the size of your foot and you've got to think bigger than that, but you also have to, you know, stand strong. You have to do your job well if you're trying to think outside of your job and all of those things. So there's that one. And then I won't use the expletive for this crew, but don't be a jerk. This industry is one where you're going to run into the same people. Well, good. Great. We'll put that in some, you know, there'll be some dollar signs. Yeah. Edit that in, please. But don't be a jerk. You're going to be around people. Make friends, be a friend. Don't always do something just because you're asking something of somebody else. Do something for them. And then maybe if you need them later, they'll be able to offer that support. But it's very important to think of these people as people and not just professionals.
Mm-hmm. Great advice. And then finally, how do you stay smart? What do you read? What do you listen to? Who do you follow?
I appreciate your thinking I'm smart at the outset because I was not the best student. So the stay smart mantra you just gave me, I'll take it.
Okay, good.
But honestly, what I do is listen, and not just listen, actively listen, whether it's to podcasts like this.
Really? Raleigh obviously did her homework on our podcast, Joe.
But you have to actively listen, and you can't just think about the next thing you're going to say or the next question you have. You really have to evaluate those things. So even if you're taking notes, go back and think about something that said, create your own opinion, challenge somebody on it, but be willing to say you're wrong. So actively listening is really how I stay smart. And that could be listening to learn about a podcast. It could be about newsletters. I look at the Daily from the Times in the morning. Then I also look at Axios, hashtag Front Office Boards and SBJ, just to make sure I've gotten the full suite. Right. And then I'll listen to friends as they talk about stuff. And the other side of staying smart is staying balanced. I make sure I get 1 hour of working out every day just because, and that honestly could be on the Peloton, just watching some Netflix thing that sounded quite hip to put all those things together.
Really?
but staying balanced and having an hour to yourself to process that stuff allows for the creativity that makes you smart and makes you a better, more active listener.
Are you a podcast fan?
I am, absolutely.
So what do you like other than the Daily?
You know, other than the Daily and other than the Cusp, I'm a big fan of how, you know, Simmons and his podcast will roll into the Spotify portfolio. Something really great to listen to. We have a lot of athletes that have rolled out podcasts, so a lot of my time is listening to those and really figuring out what works for their audience.
Raleigh, just out of curiosity. That you like to
listen to. One more time. I'm so sorry.
Who are some of the athletes that you podcast that you like to listen to?
Yeah. So there's a gentleman named Carl Scott at the Players Tribune, who's their head of audio, and he put together the Knuckleheads. It's done phenomenally well. And I really just like the way that they curate it. But a lot of our athletes in some of their more recent downtime have started to do podcasts, and you'll start to see stuff from Sue Bird and Megan Rapinoe and extensions of some things they're already doing. So a lot of my time is lent to making sure that those have some wings to succeed.
Great. Amazing. Okay. So how do people find you and follow you?
If you really want to.
If they really want to.
Yeah. So they call my husband John Gray USA, which is why I acquiesce, and I am R.A. Gray USA. Okay. So you can find me there on Twitter and on Instagram. And then my personal website for work is Must Love Sports, spelled out, no heart like I heart New York, although I do, mustlovesports.com. And it's really just an opportunity. We put out newsletters and things like that, but it's an opportunity to collaborate with others and have a shared connection to challenge sort of where we're going, much like you guys are doing with these tough questions today. I'm so glad I'm not back in school. I would fail miserably, but thank you.
No, it was terrific. Joe, is there anything else you want to say or ask?
You know what? Because we didn't touch on it. You want to give us the 2 minutes on Must Love Sports?
Yeah, sure. I just realized as you were answering the question how we forgot to bring that up. So yeah, two minutes is fine.
I thought you were going to ask me to get you verified, and I was going to end this.
Sorry, I already am, but thank you.
There you go. That's it.
I have verification envy with Joe.
Someday, Tom, someday.
Okay, someday. Yes. I keep trying.
So Must Love Sports actually arose out of my move from San Francisco back east and just was an opportunity. Honestly, I had some great quarters when I worked with DraftKings and FanDuel when they were battling it out. And I had the opportunity to take some of that and put that back into getting people together that are like minds, whether it's ladies in the game, as I call the women's initiative, or we get together at the NBA All-Star game and just have cocktails, no pretense, no conference, just conversation and making sure you met somebody. So like I talked about, it's easier to do business if you have a relationship and a shared understanding of who that person is. So that's what Must Love Sports is. We also have some extensions that we're working on to support summer interns, which is really exciting. So they get exposure to our network as well. And thankfully, no jerks or no other word in this industry. So most of my friends are happy to share, which is great. So it makes Must Love Sports pretty easy because I'm getting by with a lot of help from my friends.
That's great. So, yeah, nice. That. Wait, with my Beatles record in the background of the for those who've seen the video side of this. Raleigh, thank you so much. That was terrific. Real pleasure.
So much fun, you guys. Great way to spend
So you have to come visit us. You have to come visit us on campus when we get back to campus. This is our campus right now, pretty virtual, but hopefully sometime before the end of 2020, we'll be back in Morningside Heights. So come up and visit.
It'd be an honor. Thanks, y'all.
Okay. Joe, thank you for a good show.
Yeah, it was great.
Thanks to our special guest producer, LJ Holmgren, for helping us out today. Always appreciate it, LJ. And guys, to the audience, thank you again for listening. Please check us out. Check out the other shows. As Joe might have mentioned, or maybe this was in the pre-call, that we released a lot of podcasts that actually go back to January, but there's still a lot of really good conversations from that little trove that was built around the Super Bowl. So check out those shows. If you have any feedback for us, reach out to us on Twitter at Joe Fav, at ConvergenceTR. Send us a note. We're happy to get some feedback. And if you have any specific questions, we're happy to answer those too. So thanks again to Raleigh Gray from Athlete Exchange Wasserman on a terrific conversation. Guys, we'll talk to you soon. Stay well.